The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events, and I'm excited to introduce our guests. Named the first chairman of the Jordan Brand Advisory Board in January 2019, Larry Miller led Michael Jordan's $200 million basketball shoe company to become a $4 billion athletic apparel global powerhouse. After founding the Jordan Brand at Nike in 1999, he was president of the Portland Trail Blazers from 2007 to 2012 and has served in leadership and advocacy roles for the Urban League, Junior Achievement, and Self-Enhancement, Inc. In Jump, Miller begins his story with the violence of his 1960s West Philly upbringing and incarceration and shares his later opportunities of education, redemption, and success. His co-author, Lila Lacey, is a native of Philadelphia and graduated from Central High School. She earned a degree from Howard University in Washington, D.C., where she studied psychology and human communications, and also studied at New York's Bank Street Graduate School of Education. Lacey taught middle school for the New York Board of Education and later served as a business development manager for several mortgage banking firms in California. Tonight, they'll be in conversation with Fat Joe, rapper, producer, platinum recording artist, and host of The Fat Joe Show. Please welcome Larry Miller, Lila Lacey, and Fat Joe.
Crew here. Love it. Both Cedar Avenue gang here.
What's up, y'all? My name's Fat Joe. How y'all doing, Philly? What's going on? So we here for the man, not the myth, Larry Miller. I go back with Larry 20 plus years. I remember when I first met him, I'd be like, hey, how you doing, Mr. Miller? Like, you know, like all proper and stuff. And so when he gives me the call and he talks, well, I was, first of all, Larry, I was honored to receive a call from you, for you to even say, yo, Joe, I wrote a book and it's about this. And we talked for like an hour, at least an hour or two, and he was breaking down this whole, I was like, no way. And he was like, Joe, what you think? I said, this is necessary. Because a lot of our people, especially the youth, they have to see it to believe it. Stories like what Larry got, it comes once in 100 years. And so it's important that we keep the transparency with the wins, with the losses. And it's amazing that you have me, I guess we hosting or curating, along with your beautiful daughter. Do you got a man?
Thank you.
Talk to the people.
Hi, everybody.
Oh, she's not a talker. Huh?
I'm not much of a talker, but hopefully I'll get better. I'm seeing a lot of familiar faces out there, so that's very comforting. I'm so thankful that y'all are here and are interested and want to read about this. It was a long time, a lot of work put in on it, but here we are.
So, Philly, are you proud of Mr. Larry Miller?
Yes.
And Larry loves everybody, but this is truly black excellence right here. And Larry, what made you finally say I'm going to write a book about my life and be as honest as you was in your book. A lot of people like to carve out stuff. What made you tell the real story?
Well, first of all, if it wasn't for her, I probably wouldn't have done this. But she, over the years, kept telling me, you know, Dad, you got a story that that people need to know. You need to share this story with people. And I kept like, nah, because for 40 plus years, you know, I hid this story because the folks I was working with, the world that I was in from a corporate perspective, you know, I knew that this story wouldn't work there, you know what I mean? So I just kind of kept it in and did everything I could to hide it. But once she convinced me that, you know, this is a story that can help some people, that can resonate with some people, and maybe, you know, get some young folks to look at their lives a little bit differently. So so we agreed to do it. And then we started working on it. It took us like 10, this was probably 10, 12, 13 years ago we started.
Wow.
We would get together and sit down and she'd ask questions and we'd talk and she would record it, right? And then she'd go back and transcribe it. And we did this over 10, 12 years, maybe 3 or 4 times a year we would get together. It, basically on my schedule, because she'd be like, can we do it? I'm like, yeah. And finally, I'd be like, all right, we can get together today. So we started working on it. Like I said, we went through that for about 10 years or so. And then at the end, we had this document, but it wasn't really in a book form. So it's like, okay, now we got to figure out how to turn this into a book, and we did. But to me, you know, the main reason that I decided to do this was because, you know, I wanted, number one, I wanted people to know that folks deserve a second chance and that people can change their life. You know what I mean? People can, you know, change their life and get on a positive path and do some positive things. The other thing, the other reason that that we agreed to do this is because there's a certain stigma with having been incarcerated, with having been arrested. And a lot of times it keeps you from being able to get a job or get an education or to move forward. And so hopefully this story will resonate with some folks who make those kind of decisions and make them have maybe a different perception of formerly incarcerated people. And then, you know, third, hopefully to me, you know, maybe there's a 16-year-old Larry Miller out there somewhere that's headed down the wrong path, about to do something stupid that he'll regret for the rest of his life. And maybe this will, we were talking about this earlier, Joe, maybe they see this and it changes their mind or it makes them stop and think for a minute before they go out and do something that, like I said, they're gonna regret for the rest of their life. So, you know, and once we decided to do it, you know, like I'm the kind of person, if I do something, I'm not gonna half-ass do it, I'm not gonna half-step, you know what I mean? So once we decided to do it, it's like, okay, we're gonna put it all out there, you know what I mean? And that's what we did.
Beautiful, man. 12 years in the making. So one thing you said that's really, really, that resonates with me and really pounds my skull is a second chance. And
third,
they always say
and the third
possible.
And the fourth and the fifth.
They always, you know, the American dream. You know, when I was a little kid, we would watch cartoons and it would be like $1 million. Like it's always $1 million till you get $1 million and you spend it in a year and go broke. And you think you own like a cloud. And the second chance reminds me of that same thing, because they always say it's a second chance, but is there really a second chance? Do people really, you know, once you like have a reputation, it seems to follow you forever, and nobody really wants to hug you and embrace you and give you a second chance. So that resonated. So you started out here in Philly. Would we say you was hanging with the wrong crowd?
I would say I was part of the wrong crowd.
That's right.
No, you know, from like all through elementary school, man, I was like straight A student, you know, T teacher's pet kind of kid. But somewhere like 11, 12, 13 years old, the lore of the street just kind of pulled me in, man. I just, you know, the whole element of like being cool and being out there in the street. And before I knew it, you know, my goal was to impress people in the street versus teachers and parents at that point. Up to that point, it had been, you know, I want to impress the teachers and parents, but it started to shift. And then I remember, I don't know if Butch and Tyrone are here today, but two of my friends, Butch called me up about a couple months ago. He's like, yo, you remember the day we decided we were going to go down and join Cedar Avenue? I said, yeah, I remember that day. me, Butch, and Tyrone decided we were going to go down and join Cedar Avenue, and we did. And you know, I just, once I got into it, I got all the way into it.
Man, and I can relate. And unfortunately, same old story of, especially your time and my time, because I remember growing up in the Bronx where it looked like a war zone. Like, you know, the there was no playgrounds. It was just rubble, right? And so I remember being ambitious too as a kid, just saying, yo, I'm gonna get rich or die trying. Like, I'm like, this poor thing ain't for me. And so I understand. And then all we had to look up to was the number man, the hustler, the toughest guy got the power. Was that true in your life as well? Like, was you getting more popular, or for some reason they were like looking up to you because the crazier you got?
Yeah, I mean, for us, it really wasn't about money. You know what I mean? It was more about this is, you know, we laid claim to a territory, and it was really about brotherhood. It was about being a part of a brotherhood. I mean, you know, we were willing to live and die for each other back at that point, you know? And like I said, it wasn't really about money for us. It was more about, hey, I want to belong to something, and, you know, this was what was there for us to belong to. And you know, the good thing, I mean, in our neighborhood, like, you know, we ain't let nobody else come in the neighborhood, but we looked out for the people in the neighborhood. You know, oh, chill out, man. Here comes so-and-so mom. Be cool. How you doing, Miss So-and-so? Yes, ma'am. Soon as she walked by, all right, mom. You know what I mean? But it was like, that was how we rolled in the neighborhood back then.
That's traditional gangsterism.
Yeah.
Like, guys like John Gotti. You know, his neighborhood was safe as hell out there, boy. But they throw parties out there when he was out there. So at what point did you get incarcerated again and again and again until the major thing?
So the first time I ever got busted was...
busted!
pardon me.
No, that's the talk. That's
the first time
that's
I
the
was
error. That's that talk. Like, I haven't heard busted in a while.
The first time I was ever arrested,
arrested.
Me and Tyrone stole a bike, and we took it to Tyrone's backyard. We in the backyard stripping the bike down, and this lady walks up and says, can I see that bike? Everybody's like, oh, shit. So we start running. I run through the house and come out the front door. As soon as I come out the front door, there's a cop waiting there for me with his gun drawn. He's like, you know, stop or I'll blow your brains out. So, of course, I stopped. And that was the first time I ever had a contact with the police. So I ended up getting probation for that. But then we joined the gang, and from that point on, I was just like, you know, every so often I'd get busted for something. And then, you know, when I was 16, I shot a kid and killed him, and I went to jail. I was tried as an adult and sentenced to 4.5 years, 4.5 to 20 years. I did the 4.5, most of that up at Camp Hill, which folks here know what Camp Hill is. Did the 4.5, got out. Knocked around, doing a bunch of stuff here and there, in and out again. And then I joined the Nation of Islam. And that kind of turned my life around. I stopped using drugs, stopped smoking, stopped drinking, all that. And I sold fish, went door to door. Bean pies, fish, papers, that was me. And then, you know, at a certain point, I started to feel like I wanted to do more for the nation financially. So the only thing I knew was to get back into criminal stuff, and that's what I did. I started, you know, selling drugs and extorting money and robbing people, and that's what landed me back in jail. When I went back the last time, I had like four or five robbery charges. Ended up getting sentenced to 4 to 10 years. Also, the crazy thing is when I still had 15 and a half years of back time to walk out. The way it worked here in Pennsylvania, I don't know if it's still that way, but if you're on parole, let's say I had 4.5 to 20, so I had 15 and a half years that I had to walk off. Once I got busted again, like 5 years later, they took that 5 years away, and I still now had 15 and a half years of back time. Ooh. All over again. But I've been so blessed in my life, man, that they could have made me do the whole 15 or any part of that 15, and they only made me do 9 months out of that 15. So I did the 9 months and then started the 4-year sentence. But when I was there, they had this program. It was an educational, they had work release and education release, where you could live outside the jail in these trailers and leave every day and go to work or go to school, and you just had to be back by 8 o'clock at night. And I figured out how I could get into that program. And for me, the motivation for getting into that program was, instead of being in the jail, I'm gonna be living out there and able to go out every day. But once I kind of got into it and started taking the classes and really started to think about whether or not I could really change my life, that really was what did it for me. I ended up in that program and went to community college in Montgomery County, left every day. Matter of fact, at one point I became a driver, so you drive people and come back and forth, and we had to be back by 8 o'clock. There were a lot of days it'd be 7:59, 59, and we'd be pulling up in that bad boy, because if you were late, you go back inside. And there were a lot of days we made it by the skin of our teeth, but we made it back. And then I transferred down to a halfway house in North Philly at 15th and Columbia, and I started going to Temple working on my bachelor's degree. And and all along, you know, I was still a little bit, you know, kind of walking the fence a little bit.
Let me interrupt for a second. That's technically really hard to do, right? So you come out of prison, you was doing the right thing because you were in prison, major key, you realized in prison, hey, I'm kind of smart. Like, I'm kind of good at this, right?
Exactly.
But when you come home, it's the same old story. The minute the guy could be clean, he went to jail for 5 years, he comes home and Tito's like, Larry, I got it. I got the stuff. Blow your mind, high-powered, bro. How did you navigate from those guys telling you, Larry, come back, man. What are you talking about?
You know, most of the reality is most of my friends, most of the people that I know who knew me, they were encouraging me to do the right thing. Mm. They were encouraging me, like, hey, you know what? And you know, there were a couple times, like, I thought about, you know, I never forget, there was one time when I knew I was done, right? Some brothers had asked me to set up a meeting with this brother that I knew from in jail. And so I set up the meeting. We go down he was set up in the pool room. We go down the pool room and we go in, and I kind of introduce everybody. And then I was standing there and I was just like, why am I here? I was already working for Campbell Soup at the time. I was like, you know, this don't feel right. So I said, you know what? I'll wait for y'all outside. And I went out and let them handle what they were handling. And then from that point on, because, you know, I knew if my heart wasn't in it, if I was half-stepping, that wasn't going to work for me. You know, I mean, that's dangerous if you're in that world and you ain't really about it. So that's when I kind of knew, you know what, I'm going to stay focused on trying to do it this way.
That's crazy, right? Because I have a story that's similar. And growing up in the projects, I was always, so now I know why he's Fat Joe, right? And so I would always be like the mediator. So this guy's gonna kill this guy, this guy's gonna kill, somehow they would always call me. And I would end up in the middle of guys with guns pointed at each other. And I'm like, yo, chill, yo, hold up, yo, we could do, and we would always work it out. And it's crazy because at one point they came to me and they said, and this isn't too long ago, right? They came to me and said, the only guy they respect is you. this guy's gonna kill, and these guys are killers. Like, they're gonna, it's gonna be the biggest war. But both of them said they'll only sit down with Fat Joe and this and this and that. And I said, listen, guys, you see that guy? He said, yeah, he's a retired cop. Okay? And he's my security. And I'm a rapper. I'm not about to get in the middle of some killers and start mediating nothing. That's over. No, but you like us, you'll get, it's over, bro. Mm-hmm. I ain't having guys point guns at, you know, in my, it's over for me. That's when I knew, finally, like, yo, Joe's out of this thing, right?
But I like I said, I have to say, man, most of my friends, most of, you know, corner boys, brothers from the Nation of Islam, everybody was supportive. When they saw what I was trying to do and that, you know, I was trying to, you know, make a move in the right direction, I got a lot of support from people.
Man, it's so crazy, man. I was in the supermarket with my wife the other day, and I wanted a Campbell's soup. And she said, you always eating bad. That stuff got so much salt in it. And so how do you transition from Campbell's soup to becoming the chairman of Brand Jordan? How did these steps take place?
So when I was about to graduate from Temple, the way they set it up, like, you know, on campus in your last semester, all these companies come on campus to interview for jobs. I learned early on, like, if you want to be good at something, you got to practice it, because practice makes you confident, and confidence is what makes you good at whatever it is you do. So I took a bunch of interviews with companies that I knew I didn't want to work for. For whatever reason, I knew I didn't want to work with those for those companies. But I took those interviews to get the practice and to get the confidence. And so by the time the companies came on campus that I was interested in, I was killing it, because I knew what to say. I knew the right answers to all the questions.
You knew what they wanted.
I knew what they wanted to hear, and I was giving it to them. And so, but then there was, my undergraduate degree is in accounting. So I'm an accountant by trade. That's what I was, you didn't know that, did you?
No, I wouldn't have went to jail if I knew accounting. If I knew you was an accountant, I wouldn't have went to jail for taxes.
Should have talked to me, brother.
I'm sorry, man.
But at the time there was what was called the Big Eight accounting firms. And if you were an accounting student, that's who you wanted to work for. And so I had interviewed with a bunch of accounting firms, and it was one, Arthur Anderson, who I was really interested in working for. So I go to their office, they invite me, I go through a full day of interviews, and I'm killing it, they love it.
No disrespect, Larry, are you answering the question, have you ever been incarcerated?
No, I'm getting to that.
Okay,
I'm getting to that.
I don't want to steal your thunder.
I'm getting to that. That's the story. So I go through this whole day of interviews. They love me. It's good. And then I get to the last guy, who's like the hiring manager. This is the guy that's going, you know. So the whole day, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, should I say something to these folks or not? Should I just, you know, should I say something about it? So finally I get to the last guy and we talking, so I'm like, okay, I'm gonna say it. So I start to tell him about my past. And I'm going through and talking to him about it. And as I'm talking, I could see his face changing. You know what I mean? I could see his face changing, and
for
I'm like,
for the best or for the worst?
For the worst. I could see his face. I could just see, like, okay. And then I keep talking, finally I get through, and he said, wow, that's an amazing story, and, you know, and I'm sure you're going to do great. He reached in his pocket. He said, you know, I have an offer letter here that I was all set to give you, but I can't give it to you now. He said, I can't take the chance of, you know, something happening, blah. He said, I wish you the best. And at that point, I was like, I'm never going to say anything about this again. If it comes out, and when I started working for Campbell Soup, the question was, have you been convicted of a crime in the last 5 years? Well, the answer was no. Because it's been longer than 5 years. And so I was able to answer
that question. It's a
loophole. I was able to answer that question, no. And that's how I started working for Campbell Soup. And then as I went forward, there was very few, nobody ever asked me about that again. I was based on my resume or whatever. So, you know, I didn't really lie about it. I just didn't say anything. And that's what, for years, had me nervous, worried, and concerned that it would come out. As I was building my career, you know, I'm worried that at some point, You know, somebody's going to hear about this or somehow it's going to come out. And fortunately for me, it never did. But that was what, and for years, you know, I had nightmares and migraines and all because I was holding all this in and worried about the fact that, you know, somebody would hear it, would come out somehow.
It feels like them classic movies when you with the team, you working, they were like, Larry, you know, Bang Bang City, baby. You like, no way. You probably was missing the Philly events. Like, you was like, no Jordan parties in Philly.
No. We still came to Philly. But you know what? What I have to say, and somebody said this to me one time, but my Philly homies, nobody ever said anything. There was one time, a friend of mine, this brother George Hill. I talked about George a little bit earlier today with somebody, but George was from my gang growing up, and then George went in the military, and then George joined the sheriff's department. So when I would get busted, George would be the one like moving me around and moving me from cell to cell. But we were always cool. He would bring me stuff, look out for me. And then when I was at Graterford, which is the penitentiary here, George used to come up there with boxing programs. He would referee and come up with, because George was into boxing. And then when I got out and I started working with Roy Jones, I hooked George up with him where he was using George to ref some fights and stuff. And I was at a game one time, this is when I was with the Trailblazers, and I was at a game. And
by the way, he was the boss of the Portland Trailblazers. I don't know if y'all know that. He was at Jordan. One of my worst days of my life was when he called me and said, Joe, I'm going to be the boss of the Portland Trailblazers. I said, man, I blew my connect at Jordan, man. He said, if you ever want to come to a game, I said, man, I ain't going to no Portland.
Come to a Trailblazers.
Come on, man, Larry, man. Listen, the scale done tipped, man.
No, but you made me lose my train of thought.
Oh, I'm sorry about
George Hill.
George. So I was at a game, I'm the Trailblazers, and I get a tap on the shoulder, and I turn around, this brother I know, been known him for years, good brother, he said, you know a guy named George Hill? I said, yeah, I know George. He said, man, you need to tell George to chill. He said, George is bragging about you, man. He's telling people how great you, he said, but I ain't gonna say nothing, but somebody else might, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
He said, that brother, to his credit, he never said anything else to anybody else. He said, told me, never said anything. I called George the next day. I was like, yo, man, I know you bragging and stuff, and he was like, oh, I ain't know, man. And George was cool from that point on. But if George had talked to somebody else, that might have been a whole different
thing. You know, boy, what I noticed is a lot of people can't keep a secret. As much as they think they can keep a secret, so if you got a good secret, keep it to yourself. Because, man, it's just human nature.
Tell you about one other time. So when Obama was president, there's a guy that worked at Nike who is like the lobbyist for Nike in D.C. And he you know, he works with all the people. He worked with Obama. And all. So Obama was coming to Portland to speak out at Nike, on campus at Nike. And the night before, he was having like a little reception at one of the hotels downtown. So dude said, hey, man, they want you to come to the event with Obama. All right. So, you know, I sent him my information, but all the time I'm scared to death, right? Because
that's the camera.
See, this was Obama's last year in office, actually. So I'm waiting. The event is on Thursday. That Wednesday, I still haven't heard anything. I'm like, okay, I guess maybe. So I'm driving in my car, and I get a call, and it's this guy. His name is Jesse. He said, hey, man, Secret Service just called me. He said, what's your middle name? I said, my middle name is Garland.
Sheesh.
It's Garland, that was my grandfather's name. I said, it's Garland. He said, oh, you good, man. He said, there's this Larry G. Miller dude that got all kind of felonies and shit against him.
He's a bad dude.
I was like, okay. He said, but you good, man, you good. I said, all right. And the next night I went and saw Obama and met Obama. But I mean, somehow they didn't put it together. Somehow they didn't.
I know
put it
this
together.
Guy come, man. This guy, this is like a movie. This reminds me of like the movie Malcolm X, right? Because there was this white guy, he was on me. He was like, man, this is Guy Obama, and we need the Latinos, and we need the, and he hyped me up, man. And I was going all over, yo, man, y'all gotta vote for Barack. This, tell him, all the Spanish people, this and this and that. And I tell this guy one time, I said, yo, man, when can I meet? He wasn't even president. He said, oh, no, you can't meet Barack Obama, sir. He said, you and a couple of your guys, you can't meet him. I said, damn, I'm on the list. Scared the hell out of me, right? And so at what point, because we got to get back. You was in Campbell's. Mm-hmm. At what point? Did you meet with Brand Jordan? And how did you rise through the ranks in Brand Jordan?
So when I was worked at Campbell Soup, I worked for Kraft Foods, a couple other places, and then I ended up working for a company called Janssen. And Janssen makes swimwear, sportswear, and they were headquartered in Portland. So I started out at Janssen as the controller, because again, accounting background, right? Mm. And I was there. About 2-3 years after I was there, they actually fired the guy who was the president, and they put me into the president role, right? But before that happened, one of the things I had gotten involved in, me and some guys were sitting around one day trying to figure out how we could grow our business, right? And one of the things we came up with was an idea to do like competition swimwear. So what we were doing was stuff you wear on the beach or on the cruise ship. But then they wanted, we came with this idea to do the Speedo type stuff that they wear in the Olympics, right? Mm. And I was like, you know what? We should talk to Nike, see? Because we were in Portland, they were in Portland. Long story short, we ended up connecting with Nike. I met the guy who headed up all of the apparel for Nike. Mm. And after about a year or so in that role, because I ended up at Janssen for 5 years, he reached out to me and said, hey, would you ever consider coming to work for Nike? Mm. I was like, absolutely.
That was sexier than Janssen, yeah. Right?
So I start my first job at Janssen at Nike was the head of apparel in North America, in the U.S. And that was about $1 billion business at the time. So I was like, yeah, I do that. And about a year and a half in, MJ was about to retire from the Bulls for the last time.
Hold on. Because this is crucial. You get the job at Nike. Nike's Nike, and we love Nike, right? But then Jordan is a brand within Nike.
But it wasn't that way when I started. That was the whole deal. When I started there, Jordan was a logo kind of under Nike basketball. So they had Jordan logo, Wings logo. They had all these logos under Nike basketball. And when MJ was about to retire, my main man, H. White, H. was like, you know, hey, he was one of the main proponents of the fact that he thought there was life after MJ's retirement days for the brand. And me and him talked a lot about it. And so we convinced Phil Knight, H. mainly, but convinced Phil Knight that we could do something with that logo after Michael's playing days. And so I was asked to put a team together and strategies on how we were going to create a brand, basically.
Had anybody else done this before?
No.
No Charles Barkley? No.
No, no. And
we better watch what we say. Charles would diss us. You know, he ready to go.
And especially with a player that was retired. You know, MJ was retiring. So now, matter of fact, a lot of the people at Nike, a lot of our customers, all they thought it was crazy that we were trying to do this. I remember one guy, we went and did our pitch to him, a retailer, and he said, man, I'm going to go with y'all on this because I feel like I have to because it's Nike. He said, but this will never work. 2 years later, I saw him at the Magic show. He's like, man, I owe you an apology. I said, for what? He said, well, I told you this wasn't going to work, but I was wrong, and can I get some more Jordans? So you know, that's how the brand actually got started. And, you know, I was fortunate enough to put an incredible team of people together. Phil Knight accused me of cherry-picking the organization.
No, it was the first time I seen, no disrespect, a bunch of black Obamas, like really, really smart guys. And when you had your team, it was if you ain't see it, you was everybody was like an intelligent black man, intelligent black sister, intelligent black, and you knew that you was building something that we had never seen before.
That wasn't by mistake, Joe.
Right, but elaborate, Larry.
No, that wasn't by mistake. I mean, when we started out, that was the goal. First of all, to build, you know, a team that was diverse in its nature and make sure that we had, because we knew who our target consumer was, right? Mm. Our target consumer was that kid in the hood, black, brown kid in the hood, who was the leader on his team, the baller, the best dresser. That's who we targeted. And so to me, it's like in order to talk to that kid, we got to be able to communicate with him. We got to know who he is. And the best way to do that is for us to be involved.
That's right.
And so we put together a team of incredible team of people. Still got some of Reggie. Folks like
they're Gentry. Just all smart guys. I don't know how to explain it to you. These guys are intelligent. You sit with them for once. Whenever they even introduced me to a new guy, yo, Joe, this is Reggie. New. He's like, I know he's smart already. Like I know, yo, this guy's smart. Like he's the smartest guy. And so it was. I don't know if I want to jump off into something else, but nah, I won't. So in a sense, you build such a powerful team. Did you ever get like rejection or flack or energy from Nike, the mothership?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Because they, I mean, could you speak on it?
Yeah, no, a large part of, the way we looked at it and the way we approached it is Nike didn't need another Nike brand. So we need to be something different. And a lot of times they didn't get it because we would do stuff that that Nike brand maybe couldn't or wouldn't do, but we could because we're Jordan. And I think that made a major difference. But there was a lot of struggles inside. A lot of hesitant.
But you know this, maybe I'm jumping far ahead, but you know this is no longer a black and brown kid wearing the Jordan.
Oh, I know.
You know I go in the whitest of Oklahomas and the white boys is wearing the Jordans like all day.
I totally agree. But what we believed, and I still believe this now, is that trends, fashion starts in the hood.
Oh, yeah.
And then it goes.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the fashions, the trends, they all start there and then they go. So we believe that, hey, if we get this kid who starts the trends, then everybody else going to follow. And you're absolutely right. Now, I mean, Jordans are everywhere and everybody's into it and everybody's buying them. And that's fantastic for us. But I think if we had not started out with that focus on who our consumer was, we wouldn't have been able to build it.
Man, that's an amazing thing. And so people don't get to see that. People don't get to see how the emphasis was on building the brand after retirement and hiring brothers and sisters. And I think MJ always gets a flip. You know, we always, you know, even when you help, you get criticized. That's the craziest thing about black and brown people, that even when you help, when you step out and you help, you know, you still get criticized. Could you tell us some of the things you worked on with MJ and the company of being philanthropy, how you give back to the community, generate jobs and all that? Because people need to hear that about MJ because there's something. I don't know. There's something out there where they lie to themselves and say that MJ don't look out for the people and all that. But it would be important for you to say that.
To me, first of all, you know, he was one who was pushing like, hey, we need to make sure that we hire the right people and people that look like us. He was 100% on board with that and pushing that when we were putting the team together. You know, the other thing, when we first started, we realized that we had to and we wanted to give back to the community. So from the very beginning, we started with a program that was called the Jordan Fundamentals. and it basically was grants for teachers. Because when we talked to MJ about it, said, hey, how he said, man, we should help teachers, because he said teachers have been instrumental in his life, and he wanted to help teachers. And so we put together this program where we would give grants. Teachers could apply for grants, and we would give these teachers grants. And we did a minimum of at least $1 million a year. That was the goal at the time we were getting started. And and so we had that program. And now we've got a program in place right now. It's called the Wing Scholarship Program. I mean, we do a bunch of stuff, and have always done a bunch of stuff in the community. MJ has been leading the charge on that. But we got this. We've got a program now. It's called a Jordan Wing Scholarship, where we provide a full free ride to kids. So it started actually right here in Philly. I was here in Philly. I was at a meeting with a guy who owned a company called Villa. I'm sure you guys all know the shoe sneaker store Villa. The sneakerheads in here know. Two up front right here, they know.
We know Villa. We know Villa.
But
we know Total Sports. Right, remember? They started, you know, Philly started the fitted caps.
I know.
With the different colors and all that.
I know.
On Broad Street. But yeah, man, we know about Philly, man.
So,
we know
about so I was meeting with the guy who runs Villa, and, you know, I said, you know, these kids are so connected to our brand. They're so enthusiastic about our brand. How do we use that to motivate them from an education perspective, school? So we started this program with them called A's for J's, where kids could actually earn credits towards Jordan product by getting good grades and attendance. And we started right here in Philly with three. It was West Philly, Imhotep, and Kensington. So three schools right here in Philly we started with, and we expanded it. But once we kind of realized that, yeah, we could help these kids get through high school, but what about after high school? What if there are kids who have the ability, the desire, but they don't have the financial wherewithal to go to college? And so we came up with a program where we provide a full free ride. And we now work, we're in, I think, 8 or 9 cities now. We work with community organizations, and they funnel these kids up to us, and then we provide these scholarships. We're probably getting close to 500 kids now that we put through this program. And every year we add another 30 or 40 kids to this program every year.
You know, it ain't cute to brag about philanthropy. It ain't cute. You know, you heard that, right? I see some Muslim brothers in here, and they're Muslims. They're beautiful people. And they give back. It's almost like haram. It's like a bad thing to brag about giving back. But I think that's something definitely that needs to be heard in the hood, because they, you know, it's like that. I'm gonna tell you one of my amazing MJ stories. So I know Larry Miller 20-something years. I know everybody in the business, and they always cool with me. So one day I say to myself, I'm gonna invest in the hood, and I'm gonna open a sneaker store, because I'm a big sneaker collector and all that, natural transition. So without telling nobody, I build a store in Harlem. White marble, gold chandeliers, smells like $1 million when you get in there. Like, I'm doing my thing. And so I tell some Nike guys that I was cool with for 20-something years, I say, yo, you know, I opened a store. They was like, really? I said, yeah, like a sneaker store. They was like, who do you speak to? And I was like, nobody. I thought we cool, 20 years. Like, what are you talking about? It's like, no, it don't go like that. Like, you either get grandfathered in, or you need special permission, or you need to be vetted, right? I was like, oh no, I spent like a couple of $100,000 in that thing. I said, wow, these people really fronted on me, right? I thought we was cool like that, right? And I'm trying to do the right thing, get some jobs in the hood, right? Cause we too much trying to run out of the hood and not invest in the hood, right? And so I like to lead by example. So I go, 2 days later, you was there. They threw a party, Rand Jordan threw a party for Neiman, the soccer player, mm-hmm. Neiman Jr.
No. I remember it was Neymar.
Neymar Jr.
We were at that.
I was in there, yeah, it was like
got that a picture, me, you, Reggie, MJ, and fabulous. I got a picture of the five of us.
So it's like 100 people, right? And so I'm up in there. You know, I got a lot of pride, too. You know, I don't ask for things, right? So somebody screams over the whole room, Big Joe, because he never called me Fat Joe. He called me Big Joe, MJ, all the time, right? He said, Big Joe. So everybody's looking, right? He got a cigar in his hand. He said, your store. I'll be at the grand opening. I'm coming to the grand opening. It was so crazy. I don't know who told MJ, they fronting on your boy. That was you, Larry? That's crazy. Oh. How do you know? They was like, yo, they fronting on your boy. He was like, yo, I'm coming. And the guys who fronted on me ran over and said, I guess you got a store. You think he's really coming?
They told me, and I told MJ, I was like, yo, man, Joe gonna get a store. He's like, I'll be there to open it.
Man, that's crazy, man. And we've been blessed ever since. And in a similar fashion, we just, okay, brother. Okay. And so we just opened our third store in the Bronx in the hood across the street from the projects and all that. And we built. We built an educational school inside the store where we have computers for the students that don't own computers. Mm. Okay. So you know when the COVID went down, they talking about go virtual. These kids don't got computers. Mm-hmm. So we've been buying a million laptops and giving them to all the teachers, quiet as kept. And so we just say, yo, you know what? These kids ain't got no computers, so we opened up like and then now it's an after-school program, like with professional teachers coming in there. They needed it. It's necessary. So we got four tickets, four questions from the audience. There has been an excessive amount of killing of our youths in the city. The teens are killing each other. What do you suggest we do to reach the youth? I'll talk about that today.
You want to talk about that?
Wow, that's huge. I know we can all, as individuals, just do our best to look out for each other, look out for the child that we see that doesn't have anybody looking out for them. That's just kind of on an individual level, but I really do think that there's more that the cities can do to provide safe spaces for these children. That's such a large, many-sided question. But that's just two things that come to mind, is that maybe there's more that can be done on it. You know, I feel like it's kind of a political issue now, and so it may or may not get the right kind of attention these days, even though it's getting a lot of attention.
And they killing out here.
They kill hard. Every day.
And they killing women in New York at a fast. Women in the bodega, they shoot her. They beating them up. They killing them. They robbing them for $100. And it's like what is making these people do this?
Yeah,
we don't.
That's a really hard question. But I know one thing that I personally can do is just be that pair of eyes and that pair of hands to help somebody when I see that they need it.
I mean, that also, you know, one of the reasons that we decided to do this book project was hopefully it will, you know, help. It will maybe make some people think a little bit or stop and think about what they're about to do and realize that, you know, they may be about to do something that they're going to regret for the rest of their life. I mean, I for the rest of my life, I've regretted the fact that I took the life of a young black man. I mean, I think about that all the time because, you know, to me, there's enough going on against us as it is for us to be killing each other. I mean, that's just, you know, we don't stand a chance if we keep doing that. They got so many guns pointing at us, and then when we point them at ourselves and point them at each other, that just makes it that much more worse. So, you know, I'm one of my hopes is that, you know, this book and what we're trying to generate out of this will definitely, you know, maybe help to curb some of this.
Yes.
I believe in love. I believe in love and inspiration. And so pull a youth to the side, it's amazing that so many years ago you alluded to we from Cedar Block, right? But we don't really own Cedar Block, right? And so
Cedar Avenue, Joe.
Cedar Avenue. Okay. You know, I know Fifth and Allegheny, man. That's what I know. One well, my man Tony and Johnny's, what's the restaurant over there? Tierra Colombiana. You know I know about that spot. I just think we gotta show love to the youth. Another thing is, we all know we was crazy when we was young, obviously. And so it takes a time for kids to mature and to think past the violence that's happening and at the time. So we just got to fight with them and embrace them and show them love. And then when you say gangs, right, where are we going to, we could do the Puerto Rican parade, a million Puerto Ricans, and that night Puerto Rican kill another Puerto Rican at a bodega that night, right? So where's the pride? Black excellence, black pride, Black Lives Matter, and they get caught up in these colors in this gang. Where we just need them a little, we need to embrace them and show them that much more love so they can look past that and say, yo, that's my brother, that's mm-hmm. my cousin, mm-hmm. I love him. And I know that there's something there with what I told you right now. There's something to that.
You know, the other thing too, to me, is that we gotta try to provide some options for these young people. Like, they don't feel like they you know, like, hey, that's their life. If they knew that, hey, you know what? I can be Fat Joe, or I can be Larry Miller. They see, to your point earlier, they see somebody that looks like them. Yeah. Maybe then we can inspire them to, like, you know, put the gun down and pick up a book. You know what I mean?
I'm going to shout out Andy. That's your name, man. Andy and his beautiful library for having us. Everybody, round of applause. Right? Second question. What is your greatest source of strength, and what's your greatest gift? I believe that's the question.
Greatest source of strength is God, Allah. I mean, there's no question. That's what. If it wasn't for God, I know I wouldn't have made it through any of this. I was talking with some of my friends one time. We were saying, hey, every day we would go out the house trying to kill ourselves. I mean, that was our every day. We go out, the stuff that we were doing, we were trying to kill ourselves. It was by the grace of God that we didn't. And it wasn't us that saved us. It was really God that saved us. So, you know, there's no question in my mind that, you know, I've been blessed beyond my wildest dreams. Oof. And, you know, that's one of the reasons, too, that I decided to do this, because I feel like I've been so blessed that if I didn't tell this story and share this story, then I wouldn't be showing how grateful I am and showing my gratitude for how blessed I've been in my life. So that's my greatest source of strength. And then what was the other one?
Fear.
Your greatest gift.
Oh,
greatest
my. No.
Greatest
gift.
Fear?
Gift.
Yeah, I wrote it.
Did you write this in cursive or something? Or
yes.
In Egyptian? Oh. I don't know what's going on, man. It looking like
greatest fear. You know, I don't at this point, I guess, you know, now that I've put this story out there and I've shared this, you know, my greatest fear used to be getting found out, getting discovered, somebody finding out about my past. That's gone. I almost cursed it. But that's done now. So, you know, I don't know. I guess you know, my greatest fear is that, you know, we don't figure out a way to change things in this country, and we don't figure out a way to change things in our communities and to help, you know, young people turn their lives around. I mean, that's my biggest concern. And that's, again, why we decided to do this, is so that we can, you know, hopefully add some positive to the situation that's out there.
You just answered the next question with that one right there. The ultimate goal of the book is we got that one. And just some of you guys are writing so small. And Fat Joe don't look old, but he old and his eyes getting bad. So, you know, I might need one of them yallas. I said, would you talk about you are not the exception, but how much talent and potential there is given when they give you a second chance? That's what we was talking about how much power is it? Not just you being like Larry Miller, the greatest ever live, that other people can also use that type of opportunity. I know
a lot of brothers who have gotten out and are doing good. You know what I mean? They built great lives. They've had families. They've changed their life. And I know a lot of brothers who've done that. I think, because of the jobs that I've been in and the people that I've kind of been associated with, my story may attract some people that, maybe it wouldn't otherwise. But I know a lot of brothers who've gotten out and are doing good. So it's not, I think I'm kind of an exception, but there are a lot of exceptions. But I do think the key is, again, providing opportunities for people to feel like they can change their life and to believe that they can do something different with their life. And I think, that's the purpose for us doing this. And, I really believe that, I know for a fact some of the smartest, most creative, intelligent people I ever met, I met in jail. And if you can harness that creativity, if you can harness that intelligence and focus it in a positive direction, I think, those are the brothers that understand, brothers and sisters, that understand what's going on in the street. And if you can get their minds changed and they can bring that back and focus that positive energy into the street, I think that's one of the things that can help us move forward.
You know, it's really crazy because for a split second, you made me think about the brother Isaac Wright Jr. If y'all seen that TV show For Life, this guy was falsely convicted and became a lawyer in jail and got 20 people off of life in jail and then came home and became a lawyer. Mm-hmm. And now he's a lawyer in the same courtroom that that they convicted him. Mm-hmm. And so, he ran for mayor of New York City. And I endorsed him along with maybe one other person. He lost, but I went for him on principle. I thought that the story was amazing. It was incredible. And I wanted to support him. Let me see the book for a second. This book, guys, is called A Jump. Right? And it's very powerful. It's a very powerful piece of literature. And so we encourage everybody to read this book and to talk about it. Don't keep the secret to yourself. But you know what happens when you read a book like this? Now, Andy, I don't know if he knows about my rap career. Andy, we have not cursed today, but I have to say one. Once you read this book, you know you done fucked up, right? Because now you know that anything's possible. You could grow from poverty, go to jail. Anything is possible. And so I encourage us all to spread the word, keep it moving, because things like this, we can't let this get swept under the rug. The man is telling you time and time again, it's weird. It's really weird because, I'm into people, right? And I'm damn near, I'm 1,000,000%, I'm a therapist. Like 1,000,000%, I'm a therapist. I'm 1,000,000%, right? I'm dealing with the craziest people. But somebody so powerful as you, somebody who came from nothing, who's a chairman, who ran the Portland Trailblazers, you still had a problem. You had a flaw. Your flaw was, I don't want nobody to know about what I went through, because and then they might look at me different than this and this. And as you know, we got powerful friends. And when I hear them keep saying something all the time, I said, damn, he got a problem with it, right? And so I'm glad you got over your fear and you're able to inspire millions, because I believe that this is going to turn into a TV show or a movie or a documentary. That's what I believe. And so, Andy, anything we want to say about the library? This is a beautiful place. I want y'all to come in here, read the books. We love you, Andy.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great job. All around.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.